This is Jim Madel, recorded at the Hope Bay Reunion in Coniston by Chris Alden Lee on the 20th of October 2009.
My name is James Stuart Madel, and I was born in Holborn in London on 18th of July 1932.
And what name were you known as by Fids? Jim?
Jim, yeah. Jim Madel.
What kind of education did you have, Jim?
I had... Well, after the you know, junior stuff, I went to a grammar school, Henry Thornton Grammar School at Clapham. And then, because of the death of my father, when I was about 13, we moved to North London, and I went to Hendon County Grammar School then, and left there in 1949. That was it, my education-wise.
No college?
No. Well, my father had died, and my sister died a year later, so it was just my mother and myself there. And she had to go back to work again, which was at about 40, age of about 40-ish. You know. So I got my first job with the London County Council, in fact.
What did your father do?
Well, he was signed on as a boy in the Navy when he was 16, in 1916, and then re-signed as a man when he was 18 years old, and served till... did 12 years until 1930, and he came out of the Navy then, and I think he worked for London Transport on the tramways or something like that, and then eventually got work for the London County Council on these big estates they had in London, blocks of flats, and sort of looking after these, one, two or three, and then he was still on the reserve until about 1940, he would have been finished, but 1939 war was declared and he got called up again and went off from an office which he was running up into a destroyer working out a Scapa Flow in the winter of 1939-1940, stopping, catching ships coming back to Europe, you know, the German ships or whatever, trying to get home. And they collared a couple of them, I think. But and he served the war, he did one Russian convoy. And he was invalided because of chest problems to shore postings. He went to Scotland, in Campbelltown, Fleet Air Arm there, and we moved up and lived there for a year with him, after which we came back to London, and he was released from the service through ill health before the end of the European War. But unfortunately, he died a year later because he had it was cancer, in fact, Hodgkin's disease. And my sister, who'd worked as a telephonist with a supervisor with the American embassy, had joined the American Red Cross, worked in Europe, and she married an American technical sergeant who was a pharmacist, and she developed a brain tumour. So it was a very unfortunate period for the family.
Okay. So you had to go to work?
Well, that's basically
it. Yeah.
I mean, in those days, now, kids sort of go, they go on, they go to school and say, oh, shall I not stay on till I'm 18? Shall I go to university? And then you had to be good enough to do it anyway. But at that stage, it wasn't a prospect for me to stay on beyond the general school certificate it was then, to take that examination, which I did, and to go further into the sixth form. So I went to work. Do you want to know a series of jobs? Or?
Well, no, just tell me about the London Council job, because what were you doing?
Oh, that was very basic. Just a starting job. Well, I was working in the architects department, sort of filling forms in there. It was incredible, the number of applications that came in for people wanting to build sheds and do buildings and things like, especially in the dock areas. And they send a letter in and it should be transcribed onto an official form. And that was the job. It was extremely boring.
So but, how did surveying come into your life?
Well, that came in through the... I left there and went into... joined the Admiralty. I was taken on as a cartographic draftsman with the Admiralty in the Cricklewood, where the office was. Just before I went into the army, I was called up for national service and went into the Royal Artillery. And I did survey training in the artillery at Lark Hill.
And was, that, went up. Was that intended, or was that just one of those things that happened to you?
No, I wanted to do it, and I was selected because in those days, if you're a grammar school boy, you know, you're a, yes, sort of here. It was like having a degree today, I think. But we went to training on Lark Hill for about 6 months and passed the necessary tests there, and then went to Germany for 18 months. And did another examination out there and stepped up as far as you could go as a national serviceman, really, in terms of trade tests. Then I came back to the drawing office at Cricklewood. Did about came out in 53, went on FIDS in 55, but I used to sit and look out the office window in the summer thinking, there must be something a bit better than this for the next 40 years, being stuck in an office. It was interesting work. I'd always been interested in maps, and I was so interested in how on earth did you know where you were on the surface of this earth, you know, and this brought on astrofixing and stuff like that. And the advertisement appeared in the Daily Telegraph, I think. I applied for the job and was accepted. A couple of quick courses with FIDS before I went down on the astro work, really, you know, how to use a fixture position and so on, using field lights and star observations and what have you. And that was it, really.
Do you remember anything about the interview?
Very little.
Was it rigorous?
No. It's astonishing. I don't think we get the job today, you know, the same circumstances applying for it. It wouldn't get it, probably. I think sort of sitting here with their pipes in their mouths and saying, you know, is he a good chap or not? I think that was the attitude, really. But I have no recollection of the interview at all. But the letter came a few days later and saying, you know, offering me the job.
What kind of space was it between the letter arriving and you actually setting sail?
Well, I knew in the summer that I'd be going at the end of the year. And unfortunately, that summer I had an accident on a motorbike and broke my ankle. And I was in hospital in a plaster cast thinking, oh, God, you know, my chances have gone here. But they fortunately got it sorted before I was due to go on FIDS, which was, and in the October we did these courses, October, November, and sailed in December.
You're being trained in survey work, presumably, these courses? Or were you being trained to cope with the Antarctic?
No, just survey work. Two courses, and one at the... Only about a week's course, mainly on astro work, with a university college in London. And then the one we went out to the field station, the Imperial College field station, with Professor Stevenson, who was on the British Graham Land expedition before the Second World War.
What did you make of him?
Nice guy, yeah, yeah. I mean, he was useful to talk to as well, because he'd been down there and... I think it was 1937, 38-ish, something like that. And he knew all about it. And we had a week or 10 days there with three other surveyors, Fred Wood and Pete Wiley, Doug Bridger. And that was it, really. We were just waiting for our sailing orders then.
And you sailed on which ship?
Shackleton. We went from Southampton. I'm just refreshing my own memory now, actually.
Yeah, sure. Don't worry too much about the facts and figures, but...
No, just... We sailed on Southampton. Well, we went down there, supposed to sail before Christmas, but apparently the ship wasn't loaded. It was out of balance, you know? And they sent us all home again. So we had Christmas at home. And I went down to Cornwall with my mother to visit some relatives and came back, and we sailed on the 29th of December...
1955.
55, yes. Straight into a southerly gale. And it was like a dead ship that night. It was rolling and heaving and doors slamming and crockery crashing, you know. And we ended up in Tor Bay the next morning with deck cargo, which had come adrift, I think, and they had to re-sort all that out and have a bit of a rest up before we finally set off heading for Montevideo.
What was the Shackleton like all those years ago?
It was quite a nice ship, actually. I think it was a Baltic... One of these Baltic traders would have been bought by FIDS. And it was quite comfortable, nice cabins and, you know, everything you could wish for, really, is from the comfort point of view.
How confident were you in its seaworthiness? Or didn't you know?
Didn't even know. Happy about it, didn't seem to have any problems. There was one incident in there were two levels of cabins, and when she got rolling, there was one cabin one day, they had the porthole open, and it rolled quite a lot, and it shipped a load of water into their cabins on the lower decks. But so that they kept that shut in future, on bad weather anyway. But otherwise, it was a comfortable ship. Didn't experience any worries or anything like that, you know, so it was okay.
So you ended up in Montevideo briefly?
Yep. We had the usual 48 hours there, rampaging around before we set off to Port Stanley.
Rampaging?
To a certain extent,
can
yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it was, you know, the last point of civilization as far as we were concerned. Also, the fact that it was first for a lot of people, you know, a quite foreign place. I mean, this was an experience as well. I mean, I'd been to Germany, but that's still Europe, and this was something different, and it was wandering about the town, and everything was open all night, and you could go out and start dinner at 11 o'clock at night and things like this. But it was about 36 hours of sleeplessness, by and large, into bars, lots of drinking and buying of bits and pieces at the last minute.
Did Fitz have a reputation in the town?
I don't know. I think they were known, but I mean, there were no bad incidents. It's just a bunch of lads going out, having a last fling before they went, yeah. I think.
And then down, presumably down to the Falklands, was that your
yes,
call?
That's right, we went to Port Stanley. I had a few days there, and I last minute spending yen buying film, and I think I bought a camera there as well, and other bits and pieces. You keep thinking, oh, I might want this, I might want that. And you rush off down to the Falkland Island Company store and buy this and that. And then I transferred all the gear, went to the old Bisco, the old wooden one, which we were travelling to the bases on. And I've had about a week or 10 days in Stanley, I think it was, and then set off on the Bisco, which is a nasty old roly-poly ship. And Drake Passage. Everybody was laid out in their bunks. Well, Doc Imray, Sandy Imray, came around dispensing seasick pills to everybody before we reached the bases down there.
What was your first impression? And you'd wanted to go to the Antarctic, and then suddenly here you were.
Yes.
Did it live up to your imagination?
I noted in my diary that the first iceberg I saw was very disappointing. It was all sort of grey and dirty looking. I was expecting blue seas and skies and a lovely white iceberg floating around, or blue-white iceberg, but it wasn't. It got more... I think you're a bit apprehensive as well going down there. The whole boatload of Fids were all new ones, and they hadn't been there before. So you're waiting, wondering what you're going to meet when you got there, what sort of people you would be, the experienced ones, when you got down there.
Were you nervous?
A little bit, yes, I think so, yes, at first. Just, you know, a whole bunch of new faces you're walking into on a base, people have been there, and maybe a base of a dozen, eight of whom are going to stay there. And they're the old hands, and you get this... You're going to do things right, or and just learn the way of doing things. It's a quite different way of life, of course.
Did you settle in though? Did you adapt to it?
Yeah, quite well.
Such an unusual environment.
I think so. Yes. I think being in the army helped there as well, because you're living with guys, you know, all from all over the place. You know, although we were surveyors, we had a nice the accommodation when I was in the army in Germany was ex Luftwaffe. Place, and there were lovely barracks, and but nevertheless, you'd mix with all sorts of people there, and done all sorts of things, and in the territorials, we had to do 3 years in territorials when we came back, and I'd gone into an army airborne unit, and done the parachuting course with them, and so you know there was this behind me.
I've not come across this before. National service was a good preparation for FIDS.
It wasn't a bad one, I don't think, no. In a sense of mixing with people,
yeah,
of all sorts. Yeah. I mean, you get absolutely every type, and when you call up for national service, everybody poured in, you know, from all levels of society, really. So that did let you mix.
Do you think the FIDs were every type, or were they carefully sifted out, should we say?
I don't think so, no. very ordinary guys. I mean, like myself, I was nothing special. And you get people down there. Obviously, the geologists were qualified. The doctors were obviously qualified. Other people, a lot of them, the surveyors, in fact, went down there rather like myself. They had no formal qualifications. And they did, in fact, do a couple of years down there and come back and then go and study and get formal qualifications in surveying. Mm. So this was a big difference, I think, to today, probably. I think everybody down there has probably got a degree because of the work they're doing. It's the most scientific work. I think surveyors are obsolete now, I should think, with GPS modules.
What's your feelings about GPS these days?
Well, it's great as a surveyor. But I think it takes the fun out of things. I mean, commercially, it's much faster, quicker, more efficient, and very useful. But when you think of the time it would have saved down there, instead of going around triangulating, if you'd have gone into these various trig points and stuck up a GPS and determined where you are within about half an hour, instead of taking maybe 2 weeks going around beaconing things and doing all this sort of work, it would have... putting in ground control for the aerial photographs, it would have obviously speeded things up a lot. But on the other hand, I think it wouldn't be such an adventure, I don't think, as it was then.
So it was an adventure for you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I suppose you were the tail end of the what they call the heroic period, weren't you,
really? Well, I suppose so, in a sense, you're... still using similar equipment. Not didn't change much, and you're using dogs still, and the sledges, driving, that sort of thing. I'm certainly glad I went down there then. I don't think I'd want to go now, because it seems most of the work is summer visits, and they rush off into the field with helicopters or skidoos or whatever, do what they want to do and back to the base. But then it was a totally different thing. There's so many other things. When I look through my diary... I think, good God, you know, the time we were actually doing nothing because of bad weather, things broken down, or you couldn't do this or couldn't do that for various reasons. But it was all learning, in a way, you know, you're learning how to cope with these difficulties in a fairly hostile climate. And didn't do anybody any harm, I don't think, that sort of thing.
Did anything defeat you?
I can't recall anything that... not really, no. I think we seem to get over most things. There's lots of lateral thinking and improvisations and things like that. It's usually worked out. Most problems got solved with what you had down there to, in terms of equipment and so on. No.
Did the depression ever affect you at all?
Oh, yes, you get the blues at times, you know, you sit there thinking...
It was called the blues, was it?
Well, I did, anyway. I don't know what it was called.
How did it manifest itself?
I don't know, just a lack... some sort of certain lack of enthusiasm about doing anything and thinking, oh, God, you know, it'll be a long time before you're going home, this sort of thing. But it was very brief periods, but obviously, I mean, everybody gets a bit down at times in normal course of life, and there you do. But then something would come along, you see, you've got something to deal with, so you just got on and dealt with it. I think that's what helped a lot, in a way, that you had other things to do because of the living conditions. You couldn't afford to be depressed, I don't think, you know, you had to get on with things. Mm. Yeah.
So the blues would result in inertia for a short time.
Yeah, only maybe a day or two, you feel a bit low and think, oh, God, and then you pick up and get on with things, you know. It wasn't the lasting event.
Could it hit you when you were laying over in the field? Was that a bad time?
Yes, it has done. You're sitting around, if you get some bad weather, lie-ups or conditions which are frustrating, you know, deep, soft snow when you're out sledging, and then, oh, God, you might... difficulties carrying out your job and surveying, sledging certainly. I mean, sometimes you get conditions knee-deep snow and you might only do a mile a day or something like that. You're flogging through it. The dog's trying their hardest, but not getting anywhere because they're up to here in the snow. And these sort of things get you down, could get you down for a bit. But it was very brief. It may be only 24 hours. You think, oh, God, you know, what's this all about? And then the next day you're off and going. It's
a common quality of FID seems to be that they are phlegmatic by nature.
I would say so, yes. There's some interesting bodies, really. You know, you see other people's ideas how to deal with things and how to solve problems. Because it was a large amount of it was problem solving, I think. You know, so much time when I look back now. I mean, when I was at Viewpoint at the Hope Bay, the pest there, we only had batteries for power to drive the radio.
Otherwise,
No generator, because I was at Hope Bay. The Viewpoint, that year I was there, we built a new hut. And the people coming, going. I spent about 9 months here. I didn't spend a lot of time at Hope Bay, in fact, because I was doing a local survey there. And the most frustrating thing there was damned wind generator, which is nothing much more than an alternator with a propeller on it. I was stuck on top of a small tower. And this was constantly failing and breaking down and getting broken propellers and things like this. And so we would have batteries charged up and then it would gradually die away over the days and have no power for the radio to talk to Hope Bay. And lighting was, you know, pressure lamps, and so it didn't matter as far as that went. And the things that went on there, trying to strap broken propellers together again, reassemble them so they would turn in the wind. All these sort of things, really.
Tell me about Viewpoint, because I haven't really met many people who
yeah.
spent any time there. Was it a comfortable hut? Was it rudimentary?
At Viewpoint, the stores were landy. When I went out there, we went round from Hope Bay to Deuce Bay, but the ship couldn't get into the ice foot. There was an old hut there, which was literally about 12 foot by 8 foot, with two bunks in it and a little end with a table where you could put the primus and a wash bowl. I don't know when that was put up. It must have been late 40s, I should think. Anyway, they were going to put a new building in. Ship couldn't get into the shore, so the stores were landed, all the materials were landed on the end of the actual point itself, on the edge of Deuce Bay. And later in the year, when the sea ice formed in Deuce Bay, sledged over from Hope Bay, and then brought all the stuff back to the building site, which is about 100 yards away from the old hut, and started building this thing with putting the foundation piers in, making up boxes for cement fondue, which is the aluminized cement which generates heat to dry off quickly, and getting these leveled up using a theodolite to, you know, establish levels and the base timbers in. And everybody took a turn at building this during the year. People were coming and going from Hope Bay, and everybody had a go with a hammer and nails, and it was all pre-assembled framework. But the rest was supplied in boards, which you know, cut up and fitted as necessary. It was quite an interesting experience, that, building the hut. And it was comfortable in the end. It has four bunks in it and an SE stove, big range, and a couple of other rooms. And I was doing a local survey there myself. And it was a pleasant enough time altogether. There was an Argentinian refuge on about 40 minutes away on the point itself. They used to come across to see us occasionally, or you go and see them. There was just a refuge hut. There's only a small thing about the radio or anything. That was it, really. But during the summer, people coming and going, and at the end of the year, there's a very nice time. I was finishing off the survey, and the last group that was there was it was George Lama, Bill Nichols, Wally Herbert, and myself. The four of us stayed there and just did things. The two guys doing the Met work, Wally started doing some tide readings, and I was carrying on with the finishing off the survey, and the ice went, and we waited for the ship. The Biscoe eventually came around. right up to the shore that year, and we just stepped on board and off we went and left Wally behind with the new faces, you know. So, but I enjoyed Viewpoint. It was nice, yeah.
What was the view like from Viewpoint?
It was good. You could see across from looking north. You've got the Tabarin Peninsula and the mountains there, Mount Taylor. You could see the backside of Depot Glacier, more or less. And if you went up onto the point, you could see down the Crown Prince Gustav Channel. I think it was Bird Island, is it there? And the other one, oh, I've forgotten the names now. Anyway, you could see down the channel, yes. Yeah.
So is that a beautiful place?
Nice, yes. It's rock and snow, but it was good.
Let's just chat a bit about Viewpoint and the people you work with, because they're sadly no longer here. And Wally Herbert is the name I've heard of.
Well, yes, but yes.
Fill me in. Who and what was Wally Herbert?
Wally Herbert, well, he was my fellow surveyor at Hope Bay. And when we got there, there'd been a survey in Tabarin Peninsula Dick Kenny had done, local survey, fairly local, fairly large scale, and the choice was they were going to do another one at Viewpoint, and there was also going to be a journey down south, down the channel, up onto the plateau, and it was like, I drew the short straw, really, because I got the Viewpoint survey, and Wally was going to do the long journey. So that year, there was lots of depot laying going on down the channel, and Wally and I shared the office there, and we were swatting up on our survey and drawing up field sheets and things like that. And Wally was always thinking about what they were going to do on the journey, which in fact took place the following year, 1957. But Wally himself is a great guy, yes. A very patriotic bloke, I thought. And so enthusiastic about it. And this was the beginning of his career, you know, in polar exploration, really. And he's a very good companion. At the end of that year, you couldn't have had a better setup, I don't think. You know, four people who got on, mingled so well together and worked well together. It was great. Unfortunately, the three of them, they've all died now, so it's...
Why is Wally's name so well-known in Antarctic circles? What's special about him?
Well, I mean, he went off... he made his contacts in America. Coming home, he went... he did a journey from Montevideo right up to Canada, right through South America, and he made contacts in the with the Americans sort of dealing with polar matters. But when he came back, he went down to the Antarctic again with the New Zealanders and sledged around, and he was up on the Beardmore Glacier. I think it was it was 1911. It was the 50th anniversary, I think, of the South Pole thing, you know, when they 1911, when they reached the pole. And he was out on there, and he was around doing survey work for the New Zealanders. Beardmore Glacier, and he was dying to go further south, but they wouldn't let him. And he came back, and we were in touch. You know, I got lots of postcards, and we were in contact for a few years until about 1966, when I moved to Wales to work. And Wally was then really deep into planning his great... North Pole expedition, you know, the traversing, the crossing from Canada to Spitsbergen. And he was deep into that. He went up to, I think he went to Spitsbergen with Hugh Simpson, and he got into Greenland. He bought dogs for the New Zealanders, I think, in Greenland, and he got to know the territory there. And spent a lot of time subsequently in Greenland with the Eskimos, with the Inuit, I should say. And then did his big journey, of course, which made his name. But he was a great guy. A lot of people, I don't know, not too complimentary about Wally, but I always found him a genuine, enthusiastic, patriotic bloke, yeah.
Good to work with?
Sorry?
Good to work with?
Oh, yeah. Indeed, we got on well together. I say we stayed in contact until about 1966, and it was about 30 years in. I didn't see him again until a reunion here, in fact, the 50th anniversary of Hope Bay. He turned up and saw him a few times after that, and unfortunately he died. He had diabetes.
And George Lamour and Bill Nichols, what were they like?
They were good guys. George Lamour, he was...
How are you pronouncing it?
Sorry?
How do you pronounce it? George?
Lamour.
Lamour.
Yes, yes. And he was Irish, and he was an accountant, actually. But he came down as a meteorological man. And he was a great, willing guy. Big, gentle giant he was. He was just a man. There was never any conflict or argument with him. He got on well with everybody. Bill Nichols had been an apprentice with... I think it's Firm Stratford's, they're Bentley agents, and he'd done an apprenticeship with them, and he was a crack man at engines and motors and making bits and pieces. He was a general assistant, because he did a bit of mountaineering, I believe it was, and he was down there as a GA as a result of this experience. And I say that he was a London lad, very nice guy, and it was just everything just worked, you know. There was never any conflict. It was just everybody knew what they had to do and got on with it, you know. It's very nice.
Let's talk a bit about the work then. You're described as an assistant surveyor.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure.
Yeah,
what does an assistant surveyor do?
I don't know. They do exactly the same job, except you've got about £50 a year more as a surveyor, I think. I think the salary is less than £400 a year. I found some recent papers recently of the job offer up in the attic in a file, and I was looking at it and I was horrified. It's about £375 a year, I think. But then you did, of course, get accommodation, clothing, food,
profit,
beer and fags, you know, it's all supplies. So it wasn't so bad, really.
So and what was your task? What was your time?
Well, the first year, as I say, was extending the across the bay, the work from Dick Kenny's on Tavarin Peninsula. And I did an area viewpoint. It wasn't a very large area. It was extended about 5 miles sort of inland and, I suppose, about 3 miles across. I was doing it at about, I think it was one in 10,000 scale, which is quite a large scale. So it was establishing beacons and trig stations and things like that.
Were you using fairly prehistoric equipment?
Well, yeah, basic theodolites, Tavistock theodolites we had then. Doing the triangulation, plotting this up, and then using a plane table and Alliday to actually do detailed work, the contouring, and fill in the details with this.
What kind of accuracy did you have?
Triangulation, I'm not sure. I know we measured the baseline. I've got actually about 1 in 20,000 on that. I think it was for the middle of the. To the actual measured baseline to start this triangulation. It was the second one, the first one on sea ice, and unfortunately it was broken off because we had some bad weather and the sea ice moved, so I had to do it again on there, what we thought was land anyway. But it was all right the second time, and got good accuracies there. Triangulation, I don't know in the end what the accuracies were.
Do you feel the maps were very accurate, or they were...
Oh, I think so, yeah. I'm looking now, I've still got a copy of it, actually. But I tied this into Dick Kenny's work. Across the other side of the bay, he'd give me some details of various peaks and points over there I could reset from and link the work, as well as doing astrophix at viewpoint itself to establish its latitude and longitude and magnetic variation there, and the sun observations and so on.
And the second year?
The second year, well, during that year they'd had the Huntings were down there doing aerial photography. So on the way down to, I went to Detail Island, Base W. We were given a whole set of photographs, which you could study. And the main job there was to pick out control points for the aerial photographs and go and triangulate the area around North Lallaman Fjord and along the coast there, up to Cape Ray. and establish these various points and triangulate them, coordinate them, as I say, to provide control for the aerial photography work. And also geology, of course. The hut had only been built the year before.
This is detail talking.
Detail, yes, yes. And we quickly put up a refuge at what was then Johnson Point, but which is now Orford Bluff or Orford Cliff, I think. Mike Orford was the surveyor from the first year there. And we put up in 3 days, just one of the basic refuges. And then a party of Angus Erskine, myself, John Smith, Dennis Goldring, the geologist. Angus was also down as a surveyor. He was a naval lieutenant. And we landed at... We put ashore by the Biscoe. This was the second year. It was the new Biscoe, the steel ship, the first post-wooden one. And we had put ashore with three sledges, our tents, stores, and a great heap of dogs, which we had to, you know, we formed into three teams there. We had seven dog teams, so we had obviously had about 21 dogs altogether. And we established, camped up above the hut itself was at the foot of a cliff, and you had to climb up a very steep slope to get onto the easier ground and snow. We camped up there and trained dogs for about 2 or 3 weeks, just, you know, trying to form teams. We had one team completely composed of bitches. We had a lot of female dogs there. And two others, which we trained up and got them all running. We were okay. And we started off, went south a bit, looking for, well, Dennis to geologise and us to look for suitable trig stations. And we found one or two down there. And then we went slightly north. The whole job there at that stage was finding trig points along the coast. And we measured another baseline, which in the end didn't get extended soon enough. So that was abandoned. And later in the year, we did another one on the sea ice. And we then proceeded to go up to the... what is now Murphy Glacier. And we ran stores, we relayed stores all the way up the glacier, up onto the plateau, the Avery Plateau there. That took some weeks, actually, getting it all up then. We got up to the top in the end, and then it was decided there was no ice in Lallaman Fjord, so we were going to... Angus and I intended to sledge south on the plateau and go down to the bottom end of Lallaman Fjord, by which time we hoped there was going to be ice and we'd come up to the base again. Dennis was going with John Smith back down the glacier, geologising on the way back to the refuge hut. We split, laid a depot at the top, and we split up. And within 24 hours, we had a 7-day lie-up in this blizzard up on the Avery. And we had Dennis and John went back down the glacier, and they had a very bad experience there because they needed some provision. They shot off one day just with a bare sledge down to one of the depots, which they just found after one day's blow. It had been partly buried. They found it, but they got caught out. It came up very suddenly, and they lived, I think it was 2 days in a snow hole. You've spoken to John Smith about this probably in the past.
This is Avery Point, Avery Plateau, is that
right? Yeah, down from the plateau, going back down the glacier, yes. And they had to live in a hole for 2 days, eating the dog pemmican. You know? It was a very close shave. Dennis got frostbite. Angus and I were up on the plateau. It was 7 days. There was one bad period when we thought the tent was going to collapse. The snow started piling up outside, and it was... Oof, you can go out there. I remember going out. It was on my side of the tent. It was beginning to bulge. And we thought the pole was going to collapse or the canvas rip or whatever. So I went outside at night, and it was after dark with a torch, And it was absolutely suffocating, you know, it was so thick, it was difficult to breathe at first. And I was crawling around my hands and knees out there. The tent was lost from sight from about 10 feet away. You couldn't see it, even with the torch. And had a bit of a shovel at the snow, but it was pointless because it was building up. So the wind was blowing about 40, 45 knots, and it was just piling up against the tent wall. And the Angus had to go, and we abandoned it. And then just ensured that we took the shovel into the tent that night in case we had to dig ourselves out in the morning. But it survived, very fortunately, and it didn't collapse. So that was an unpleasant experience. Well, Angus actually described it later as he was in Greenland with the British North Greenland expedition, and a couple of years previously, I think it was. And he described it as the most frightening experience he had in polar regions.
That was your closest shave.
That was closest shave, I think, yeah, yeah. But, and that broke up. We went on, we had another day's blow. After about 24 hours, we managed to move. And then we had another vicious 24 hours. And one of our dogs died. I found him out, so went out to feed him, and he wasn't eating, the poor old thing. And but he died while I was out there. He couldn't move. And next day, the weather cleared, and we set off and went south down the plateau to the Finsterwalde Glacier. And we went down the Finsterwalde towards the head of Lallemand Fjord. And that was quite interesting. It was nice because we were the first there. Nobody's ever been down it before, and I don't think everybody ever since. So, you know, we were the only people that trod it. We ran into a quite heavily crevassed area in the middle of it, like a saucer where glaciers were coming in from all directions. And we thought we got out of it, and we were sledging off to avoid this area, and the sledge went down the crevasse with Angus in front. Fortunately, the bridge collapsed in one lump and it jammed about 6 foot down. So the sledge was on its side. So we stuck everything we could into the ground to anchor it, and got the boxes off the sledge, passed them up, recovered the sledge, and set off further down the glacier. And then we eventually got down the bottom, no ice in Lallemand Fjord. We couldn't get across into the Heim Glacier because there's a mountain range in between. So we went south down to Bourgeois Fjord, I think, isn't it, down the bottom end there. And eventually ended up at Blakelock Island, the Blakelock Refuge. We decided this time we were into June, very short days. I mean, we were sledging it sometimes at night, in the evening, moonlight night, you could travel. Very short hours. It was sort of 10:30 in the morning. It got fully light, and about 3:30 in the afternoon, it was dusk again, you know. But we went to Blakelock Refuge, decided we were going to go to Base Y on Horseshoe Island and have midwinter there. It was just before midwinter, this. Which we did. We had about a week at Blakelock. We met Peter Gibbs there. Nigel Proctor came up, and then various other people came up, and we all went back to Base Y. And spent midwinter there, which was very welcome. Stage repairs, broken bits. And then that was a day. I was astonished when we left the refuge and went to Base Y. And I got there in the evening, and I realised I'd trotted about 18 miles that day beside the sledge, which is an indication of how fit you were. Mm. It's unbelievably fit in working down there and the things you do.
How did you get back?
Well, we stayed up. The ice we got, we were getting reports from Base W, from the Tail Island, and the ice had formed. So we went back to the stage, back to the refuge on Blakelock Island. Then we went up Jones Ice Shelf, Heim Glacier, and we had Peter Gibson, Sandy Imrie came with us, actually. You got to the north end of the Heim, just on the edge of Lallemand Fjord. We climbed up a nunnasack there, which was to be a trig station, in fact. I had a look at that. And we sledged up the fjord to Tail. We did that in, We did it in a day. It was quite a long day, but we ended up at night there, and it was dark. There was no moon, and it was an amazing arrival. Really, the people on the base said they were most impressed. We turned up there and we had a radio sked with them about 6 o'clock in the dark, and said, you know, where we were and how far we were, and asked them to put the cloud searchlight on, which is a vertical searchlight they met people use to try and pick up the height, you know, reflect off the clouds and pick up the height of the clouds. So they shone that, and an oldest lamp, and we could see this just about 3 miles away. So we sledged on, and we got lost in the great ring of icebergs. We were blundering about inside this, and finally found a gap and shot through, and we were back home again.
Was it thrilling?
Sorry?
Was it thrilling?
Yeah.
All this work, all this field work.
Oh, it was, yeah. I mean, that was the interesting bit, sledging about and dealing with the weather. I mean, there's sort of times, miserable times. My sleeping bag, for instance, before we went up the glacier, there was one stage there where we measured our first baseline, and the snow was very deep and soft, and things warmed up a bit, and the tent inside was like going down to a rabbit burrow. You know, you went down the slope into the thing, and inside you got the pools of water lying on your rubber ground sheet, and sleeping bags get damp because of the temperatures there, which, I mean, temperatures are up to maybe about 40 degrees or something like that at the worst. So everybody wanted sub-zero temperatures. Because there's much better conditions. In my sleeping bag, I always remember I had cold feet at night, and at one stage further up the glacier, I decided to inspect it, and I found there was actually ice in the bottom of the sleeping bag, and they were double bags, big heavy-duty double bags, and it was frozen. There was frost in the bag. So that was pulled out and dried out over the primer stove, and things like this. So these are the things you coped with getting on a bad day. If it was warm and sleety, you get wet and stuff like this, you know.
What was the detail hut like? Was it a comfortable hut?
Yes, it was a nice hut. As I say, it was only built the previous year. Usual thing, a common bunk room with a stove in it and the sitting room, if you like, with a stove, with the radio record player and everything kept in there. Long kitchen, full-width kitchen. And then the radio room. There was a survey office. And then the workshop at the end, the diesel room. And the sledge workshop. And the bathroom, of course. I think it was there we had... I think it was at W. It was either Hope Bay or W. The bath was a 40-gallon oil drum, which had been split horizontally, ends cut out and joined together. So you had a bath. It made ridges on your backside when you were in it. And you had to scoop it out to drain it afterwards.
Was it rusty? Was it rusty?
No, it didn't rust. It was all right because it was in use all the time. But it was a nifty idea, that, I thought, yeah.
The answer to this question is probably no, and I need to quickly ask you. Were you involved in the evacuation of detail?
No, it was the following year.
That was later.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
All right, sorry for that. Do you feel that you were cautious enough in the work you were doing, that the health and safety 1950s star was being adhered to?
Well... I don't think people took silly risks, but different frame of mind, you know, you're a young man in your 20s, early 20s, and these things don't enter your mind, consequences of things don't enter your mind so much, I don't think, at that age. But generally speaking, I don't think anybody was silly about things, you know, they didn't take unnecessary risks, and you're always prepared for a sudden event, like, you know, going through a crevasse or something like that. I mean, John Smith, when we were going up the Murphy Glacier, it was one day we crossed it because we wanted to get up on some mountain on the other side. And he was playing crevasse fodder on. He was on a rope out in front of the sledge with an ice probe on the skis, and he was prodding through this, and it went straight through. He didn't have it looped round his wrist, and it just disappeared. And he heard it tinkle, tinkle, tinkle into this down this crevasse, and he thought, "Oh, I better move." And as he went to move, he pushed his ski stick into the ground, and that went through as well. And there's a great black hole. So, you know, we backed off from that and decided we'd try another route through it. And then crossing there, in fact, the snow bridge collapsed. I was separate from the other two sledges. They were a bit up glacier from me, and I remember them going across. And as they went, the bridge collapsed, and a great flurry of snow blew up in the air, and it sort of coming towards me as it was crumbling. You know, they got those dogs going very fast, and got out of that one.
So you did take risks then?
I suppose you do. I mean, if you're travelling up a glacier, they're all crevassed somewhere or other. Sometimes you can see where they are, and sometimes you can't. So yes, there's a risk there, but of course you have to you just get everything you need to get out of a crevasse, hanging handy on the handlebars of the sledge. And dogs tend to go down first anyway, because the sort of loading on their feet is greater than that of a sledge, in actual fact. You know, the sledge runners, the actual weight per square inch is less on a sledge than a dog walking across it. So the old dogs, sometimes the lead would disappear down a hole and you have to go and haul him out again. We didn't lose any dogs that way.
Yeah, and this to an exploding Met balloon.
I wasn't actually at the base, but it sounded quite hilarious. Well, a bit dangerous as well. But I think it was John Smith and Bill McDowell. They'd part inflated a Met balloon, one of these big things, and they had it in the kitchen. I don't quite know what before. But Ossie Connacky, the wireless operator, came through with a fag in his mouth, and he thought it would be big fun to stick this cigarette on the balloon, which he did, and it exploded. And it blew the door out to the kitchen, damaged the windows, burnt all the hair off his face. He had no eyebrows or eyelashes, and generally created havoc in the kitchen there.
What was the gas inside? Was it?
Yeah, yeah.
What was it, hydrogen or helium?
Well, it's something inflammable, very inflammable. Probably helium, I suppose, yeah.
But he hadn't thought that through.
Hadn't thought it through, no. He came from the mess room, he's going to the Radio Shack and, make a bang with his balloon, you know.
Permanent damage done?
Sorry?
Any permanent damage done?
No. But it was, he didn't do it again, that's for sure.
What's this about sledging at night with sunglasses?
Oh, God, that day, yes. I was coming back from Viewpoint with Wally Herbert. We were going back to Hope Bay. Well, the whole day was a bit hilarious, really. We went across the bay and we started to go up the what is known as Last Hill off the sea ice. It was a bit of a struggle. It had been warm and there was ice had formed on the snow, and it was fairly glaze ice. And I was struggling up this slope, slipping and sliding around with an ice axe, trying to get a foothold. The dogs wouldn't go. You couldn't get them up. And I had a rope to pull the dogs up behind me. And at one point, it all fell down. I slid down, ended up in a great heap of dogs, dropped off this low foot, ice foot. But eventually managed to get them up and get them going anyway. And we pulled up and went over the top Last Hill summit. And we were coming down at above the base, and it was dark by this time. We could see there was a beacon down at the Argentinian base, which was past Trinity House. And we at the top of the hill, and it was icy, an icy surface. And we started off down the slope. It's a hill known as 433. It's 433 feet high above the sea level there. And it's immediately above Trinity House. But while he set off, he was driving the dogs, and he went off down the slope. And he couldn't stop it, and it was runaway. The brake didn't have any effect. But fortunately, there was a large boulder, and the dogs went one side, and the sledge went the other, and it wrapped itself around this. So came to an abrupt halt there. Let the dogs off, and they all galloped off down to the dog spans, which were down the bottom of the hill. And Wally and I took an ice axe each and secured the sledge there and slid on their backsides down this slope, icy slope, with using an ice axe as a brake under our armpits. And I got down, wandering the hut. You know, it'd been a dark night, and I got inside, and I still had my sunglasses on. I'd been groping about, wondering why I couldn't see things, and I hadn't noticed, realised I'd still got the old clip-on sunglasses. Well, not clip-ons, but the sunglasses. Yeah.
You had some contact with the Trans-Antarctic
Expedition. Well, they were down there at the same time, yes.
Radio
community. We did, yeah. We had a couple of... it was at Hope Bay. I think Ken Hill, the operator, got in touch with them. They picked them up and you get these broadcasts. And they had the odd conversation with them down there when they were just establishing their base. And they called mocking us for living in the banana belt when they were sitting down there in extremely cold conditions. But that was it, really. Yeah.
Did you meet Fuchs?
No, I never did meet Fuchs, no.
Contact with the outside world in your era was pretty difficult, wasn't it?
It was, yes. As far as the individual was concerned, we had an air letter once a month, I think a 50-word thing which was sent, that was sent free to the UK. Mail was once a year, obviously, when the ship came round. But they were. I know there were some of the people. Most of the operators had an amateur license as well.
A radio ham,
and they used to make contact with people in the UK and all over the place, you know, and so, which was all a bit illegal, but used to go on. They used to pass messages they were not supposed to do. I think in some cases they even found amateurs who lived near somebody on the base, and they would get their parents to come in or something like that, you know, have a word over the radio. Very naughty, but...
You heard news, not long after you arrived there, you heard news of the Hungarian Revolution 56.
Well, there was, I mean, the Suez.
Yeah.
And the astonishing news that the Israelis had charged into Egypt and started that affair off, and then the Hungarian uprising.
Well, how did news of world events that reached you affect you? Because there was that sense of helplessness, isn't there?
Well, that one, yes. I mean, at that time, I remember being a bit concerned. I thought, God, you know, is this going to be another war in Europe or something? You know, if somebody starts standing up to the Russians coming into Hungary and Suez going on, oh, God, are we going to be sat down here either whipped out and taken back home or forgotten for 5 years, you know? but that was it, really. They were the two world events that occurred. Oh, and during this period, I think the Russians launched Sputnik as well, which I do remember. I remember listening to it on the radio. You know, beep, 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 this transmission they were having from their first satellite.
Do you think because you were so far away and therefore news was sparse and you were isolated, does that make and you didn't get much news, does that make... Those trigger points in world history all the more significant?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you've got a real place and time you associate them with now. We listened fairly regularly to the news on the radios we had there.
World Service or?
It would be the World Service, I think, yes. And they used to run a special FIDS program as well at one time. They used to broadcast, I think it was a monthly thing. And we listened to Fort Stanley Broadcasting. They used to have an hour. We called them irreverently the Kelpie Capers. But things like this.
So were you genuinely concerned by the Hungarian Revolution? Were you seriously concerned about
it? Well, yes. You know, the reputation of the Russians at that time was a stomp on anything. And the thought in my mind was this was... the West were going to support, you know, provide any support to Hungary. There could be a conflict there. It was simple as that. With Suez already happening, you know, there was this going on with France and Israel and Britain. And one did wonder.
A couple of final questions, then, if I may. In what way or ways do you feel that your Antarctic experience changed you?
I don't know what way it did. I think it made him much more self-reliant. I was changed because my mother told my wife that I, when I came back, I was a slightly different person. I don't really know in what way myself. I think you become, oh, I don't know, less demonstrative, I suppose, in your affections. This sort of thing, in a way, and you deal with things much more. You improvise much more when you get home. You can always sort of fix it, whatever's going on. Certainly in practical matters, you become a very practical person because you have to deal with these things when you're there. I think they're the big differences. In your personal life, it makes a difference because at that stage, you know, you come back and you're going for a job interview and you've been, oh, in the Antarctic, that sort of thing. You know, it's a
good line on the CV.
Good line, yeah, yeah, very much so.
And you learn to cook, is that right?
Oh, God, yes. That's a bit scary, really. You know, the first time you're on a base and there's about anything between 8 and 12 other people waiting with their knives and forks for your first meal that you prepare. But thanks to the Penguin Cookery Book. I think it was the Penguin Cookery Book. Very, very good. Very good volume, that.
So your first attempt at any kind of cooking was in the Antarctic?
Well, it's a little bit at home, but I didn't make extensive meals. You know, I could make myself a breakfast and stuff like that. But there, you were making, you know, full-blown meals and making bread and stuff like this. It's quite... Which I still do now, in fact. I do most of the cooking at home now, in fact.
So looking back with the hindsight of 50 years, how big a episode in your life were those handful of years in the Antarctic?
Oh, I think very big. I don't know how you put it, really. It's an uncommon experience. It was an uncommon experience, certainly in those days. I mean, now people go down as tourists, but that's not the same thing at all. And it's a shared experience. I liken it to perhaps people of military service personnel who've experienced maybe a war or something like that. Not that it was a war down there, but it's something only this group can know about and appreciate.
Shared adversity.
Yeah. And certainly going down there is something. Yeah. You know about it. It's difficult to explain to other people what it was like, or the feeling, or the comradeship, and it's something which is like a closed community almost. I think that's a thing, a shared thing, and all the incidences that happened, most people experience. They've all had their lie-ups. They've all had, you know, if they've been in a sledging base, they've all experienced crevasses and bad weather and this sort of thing. It's which you can't. You can describe it to people, but they can't really know what it was like at the time, I think. That's all I can say.
Jim, thank you very much indeed.